On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Now, if you look at the vaccination stats, they're obviously still quite high. We're now approaching a situation where 90% of all Irish adults are fully vaccinated. But if you look a little bit deeper, you'll see that the gap between those who've got their first and their second doses, has pretty much all but closed. We're joined on the line by the Chief Executive of the HSE, Paul Reid. Paul, thanks very much for taking our call today. Does all of that suggest that basically the vaccination programme is now really reaching endgame?
Well, yeah, firstly, I think if you look at where we are in the vaccination programme overall, now over 7 million vaccines administered in total, 92.5% of the adult population over 18 have received their first dose. And as you've mentioned, the gap now narrows, so for fully vaccinated people down to over 90%. We are, however, continuing to focus on trying to, sweep up any other adult population that we can or anybody entitled to vaccination. And we have a whole range of initiatives going on about to address that. But ultimately, a massive success in Ireland in terms of take-up. Our continued focus now is remaining with the 12 to 15s, obviously continuing that programme. And also now, as we prepare plans for the third dose for immunocompromised and then boosters for those in the 65-plus age categories in long-term care facilities and over 80. So a new phase, a next phase of the overall programme, I'd say, where we're heading into now.
Sure, but it's obviously a new phase which would be a lot less busy than the original phases that you've been going through. I mean, there were times in the last couple of months where you would be able to issue over 300,000 doses in a week. I presume now that you're going into the stage where you're just trying to chase the last teenagers and you're dealing with the immunocompromised and the boosters, as you've said, that's probably going to mean that a lot of the vaccine centres that we've known for the last couple of months are likely to be stood down, perhaps.
Yeah, well, our strategy is to retain much of our infrastructure, both in terms of the vaccination centres and also significant element of the resource, very skilled resource that we've built up to, A, commence the process, which I've just said, in terms of the immunocompromised and the start of the booster campaign. But equally, we do know that the whole assessment of the extent and range of which the booster campaign will continue to is still under assessment and review. And, you know, we want to be prepared to have the infrastructure and have the resource to continue that should further advice emerge. So, yeah, a different phase, very targeted phase, very focused phase we're in now. But we do need to retain significant elements of our infrastructure and resource to meet whatever requirements come for the booster.
So you're hanging on to it for the time being, not knowing exactly what sort of boosters or third doses might be needed for other cohorts?
Well, there's no doubt it's significantly less infrastructure will be in place and active than we had as we worked through the whole population. But we will keep in. And let's also remember, you know, over 2 million vaccines have been administered by GPs and now over 270,000 by pharmacies. So they equally play a major role in our vaccination campaign and I've no doubt will play a key role and we'll be in ongoing discussions with GPs and pharmacies about the next phase of the campaign. But I will also say some very targeted initiatives we have coming up looking at, you know, those vulnerable groups that we may not have fully reached to, some workers in some industry sectors like meat plants, difficult to reach communities, third level colleges planning on initiatives to, towards the end of September, address and make it reasonable and easy again for people who haven't been administered vaccines in third level colleges, and continued information to parents in terms of take up. So, you know, we're still very focused on the campaign overall.
I want to talk about the burden that the remnant cases are placing on hospitals, and I'll come to that in just a minute. But before I do, one of the major talking points this week when it comes to COVID infections or people having to isolate has been the burden on primary and secondary schools. And the figure at the moment seems to be around 12,000 pupils who are being asked to stay at home for one reason or another. There's some talk that there might be advice coming to people who are close contacts of cases that they would be allowed to stay in school until such time as they develop symptoms. That would seem like it runs the risk of those people perhaps being asymptomatic spreaders of the disease, which could possibly make a bad situation worse. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, and they're very real considerations that we have to give thought to, and NPHET, I'm very pleased to say, are giving that consideration to it. If you do stand back from it, if you just look at the volume that we are dealing with at the moment, there's about 1,300 primary schools and early learning years centres. Where we've managed outbreaks, albeit smaller numbers in the outbreaks, and about 750 secondary schools. So it's very significant numbers of schools. Thankfully, what we can say is the positivity is reducing. What we're seeing was up in the early teens, now down to about 7% overall of that age group that we're testing in the 0 to 18 age group. If you do look at it overall over the past week or so, in the 0 to 18 age category, 45% of our total tests in the community came from that age group. You know, they would represent about 20% of the population. So a very significant, disproportionate number of cases, and we are seeing relatively low positivity between them. So the feedback I am strongly getting from our public health teams who are operating on the ground is we need to balance, you know, what's necessary and what's proportionate. And there's no doubt these are difficult considerations, but certainly the impact of having children out of school where it's, you know, probably unnecessary, and the wider impacts on their social development has to be considered too. So certainly strong view from the public health teams is it is time to look at this policy now, and NPHET are doing it.
When you mentioned the proportion of cases, though, in people who are under 12, and that's a cohort of people for whom there is no licensed vaccine at the moment, and for whom vaccination would be a whole question altogether, it does perhaps suggest that as winter sets in and as the conditions allow for respiratory diseases to circulate slightly more strongly anyway, that this could become very, very prevalent in under 12s, almost universal perhaps.
Well, it's probably, you know, that's the way it's looking at the moment in terms of, you know, on a really positive side, we look at what we call a heat map of the cases on any given day and any given week. And certainly it's completely transformed on what this would have looked like in terms of, you know, what age categories would have higher numbers of cases in red versus what age categories would be in green with lower numbers of cases. And we've certainly seen a huge improvement in all of the higher age categories, you know, much more in the green now than in the red. And you do see a higher concentration, as I've just outlined, of the cases now in younger age people. So it is a factor. It is a reality of what it is. You have said correctly, there isn't a licensed product right now in terms of vaccination, and there is no strategy or plan right now in terms of vaccination under the age of 12. That's obviously, I'm sure, an ongoing consideration at the European Medicines Agency as well as others. But right now, it isn't a strategy to vaccinate below that age group. And they are considerations that we have to manage through respiratory illnesses throughout winter in normal times. And there's no doubt we have to manage it very carefully through this winter too.
You're still looking at a situation where right now, even with 90% of all adults vaccinated, that there are over 50 people in intensive care and now routinely over 300 people in hospital. And as you begin to reach that ceiling for vaccination, it looks like that might sort of be becoming the new normal. Is it likely to become the new normal where you're just going to have to put up with that level of endemic cases in your hospitals all the time? And if so, what are you doing to try and make sure that that doesn't become too big a burden?
Yeah, and I guess the phrase the new normal is something that I don't like too much, because we never quite know what that is or what it might look like, because of course, you know, it's unpredictable. But certainly on the positive side, what we are seeing is slightly trending downwards now of hospitalised cases. If at the very least it's stabilised, but begin to see a trend downwards. And 315 people this morning in hospital with COVID and 58 people in ICU. So there is no doubt, as we look forward into next year and through winter, we in the health service and the HSE are going to have to operate on the basis that we will still be dealing with COVID. So while the economy is moving on, the society is moving on, and we all want our lives to move on, the reality for the health service is we still have to manage with COVID. We still have to protect patients. We still have to have dual pathways to protect patients. And yes, it is a most likely scenario that we will always have for a sustainable period of time numbers of people in hospital with COVID, and we have to put those protections in place.
So what do you do then to make it sustainable that you might have, as a standard, 300 people in hospitals and 50-odd in intensive care?
I think the reality of it is we don't expect that would be the level as we have reached the vaccination levels that we're at, and that's what we're beginning to see. So we would expect to see those numbers coming downwards, and thankfully they haven't reached the levels that might have been forecast through the modelling. From NPHET with the measures that society has taken, public has taken. So we would like and we would expect to see those numbers continuously down. But the reality of what you said is, yes, we will have to build into our health system, into our hospitals, into our overall health practice, that we have to manage with COVID for a sustainable period of time.
And what's been done to do that? And then what are you doing as regards a winter plan to make sure you've got the space for that?
Yeah, and the range of initiatives that we put in place last year is what we will put in place again for this year. So, for example, infection prevention control measures that we see in our health system, dual pathways, an emergency for COVID, non-COVID, isolation for COVID patients. But ultimately, as part of our winter plan, we'll be continuing things that we did last year. So, for example, giving GPs access to diagnostics, direct access to diagnostics, so reducing the burden on our health service, looking at the National Ambulance Services and the role that they play in the community, not just in terms of patient care in hospitals, looking at our ongoing bed capacity and increasing that, working with the public health system, the private health system as part of capacity planning to support us, looking at virtual clinics where they're still appropriate and can add value for us, building a pandemic or sustaining a pandemic workforce capacity and capability. So a whole range of initiatives and protections in terms of nursing homes. So a whole range of initiatives that worked through winter last year. We've embedded some of them already, not just for winter, and we'll reactivate many of them for winter coming forward the end of this year.
If you think that all of that has to be sort of baked into the system and that has to be sort of guaranteed capacity going forward, I know you don't get to write the budget, but it's going to be budget time in a little over a month. How much is that going to cost you on an annual basis to try and bake in that much new capacity that has to be there on a permanent basis now?
Yeah, well, certainly, as you know, we're all heading towards submissions into the estimates and the budget process. And from our perspective and the HSC, significant funding was allocated to us last year, an increase of an extra €3.5 billion. And if you look at that €3.5 billion, about 1.7 million of it was COVID-related supports to address many of the issues I just outlined to you there. And about 750 million was kind of increases in existing cost of existing level of service, and about 1.1 billion was for new developments. So certainly we in the HSC will be very anxious to sustain funding to continue those protections for COVID and to sustain funding that would support us in building new capacity and investing in new developments. So from our perspective, we welcome the funding for this year. And we would be obviously seeking to sustain the greatest level of that funding again for next year.
Something about all that conversation reminds me of a phrase maybe coined about 12 months ago, where all of this extra spending on the health service was once labelled as being Sláinte Care on steroids. And of course, Sláinte Care has been very topical this week with the resignation of the executive director and with the chair of the implementation board. And there are a lot of question marks now around whether the Sláinte Care project has stalled or whether there is the real desire, momentum and resources to try and make it actually happen. From your perspective, where stands the project, and is it still feasible to have the whole thing done inside the 10-year window that was planned?
Yeah, well, first of all, from my own perspective, I was previously a member of the Sláinte Care Implementation Advisory Committee when it was established, before I took up my role as CEO of the HSC. When I took up the role as CEO of the HSC, it was on the basis of I particularly was quite enthused and excited by the reform agenda of Sláinte Care, still highly committed to it. The board of the HSC are highly committed to it, all aspects of it in terms of Sláinte Care. And if you just look, for example, because sometimes there's a perception that the HSE is resistant to change or too slow to change. If you look at what our teams did during COVID, all of those initiatives that were part of Sláinte Care, integrated teams working closely between the acute and community side, GPs having direct access to diagnostics, our National Ambulance Service is treating people, more about treating people at the point of care they needed. They were major aspects of Sláinte Care, which our teams implemented at great pace with great commitment, and certainly from my perspective, and I know from the board, the HSC, we are highly committed to it. And the HSC system itself, I think, should take great confidence of its capacity to implement reform. And certainly, as we look ahead, there are major aspects of reform needed, and we are not where we need to be as a health system and what the public deserve, and I'm fully committed to that.
But if all of that is happening, then why would Tom Keane be writing to other members of that advisory council that you were previously on, saying that he doesn't believe that really the initiative or the impetus is there to keep going, or that it's hitting a brick wall?
Yeah, well, just first of all, I know Tom very well from my time on the committee and in my role as CEO at HSE as well, and Tom's a man who's left a major legacy behind, a fantastic legacy of his reforms of cancer care and other aspects of the health service. And he's very disappointed that he's leaving, and indeed that Laura McGahey's highly committed to reform as well as leaving. But we have to pick it up. We have to keep moving on, and we will move on. The health system is quite a big, large, complex system that we need to simplify. We need to commit to it. And I know from the department's perspective, the minister's perspective, the funding we've received from government, from my own role as CEO of the HSC and our board, we're highly committed to all aspects of it, to pick it up, move it on, and the public deserve it. And I'm very conscious of the very significant challenges we have now after three waves of COVID, after a cyber attack that severely impacted, battered and bruised the health service. We want to pick it up, move on, address issues like the waiting list, address issues like regionalisation, address issues like integration. They are really government policies that we're highly
committed to. Yeah, on all of which sounds very reassuring on the face of it, but evidently the likes of Tom Barry and Laura McGahey have more insight into delivery on the ground, and they clearly don't seem as convinced as you are.
Well, you know, I can't comment on Laura's and Tom's reason for resigning, but I think that, you know, there's been some public commentary of it. I can't comment on it. But what I do know is leading the health service, I do know the commitment to reform. I do know the challenges that we have. I do know that the demonstrable commitment by our frontline teams, by the HSC, the role that the HSC at the centre played in working with the services through COVID, protecting people. Let's remember, we, for the past 18 months, we've been working relentlessly to protect people from getting ill, to protect people from being hospitalised, to reduce mortality and save people's lives. That has been a big priority for the past 18 months. And we can't forget that. And even during that period, you know, major elements of reform. But again, major elements of reform still to be done, and significant challenges for the health service, which, you know, I'm committed to.
If you're just tuning in, Paul Reid, Chief Executive of the HSE, is with me this lunchtime on The Record. Paul, can I ask you to comment on a story that's on the front page of the Sunday Times today? It states that the start of construction on the long-awaited, and a lot of people will know some of the tumultuous story about the new National Maternity Hospital on the Elm Park site beside St Vincent's, has been delayed because the HSE's board members have rejected the proposed governance structure for fear that it will give control of the facility to the St Vincent's Healthcare Group. First of all, can you confirm that the board has in fact rejected that governance structure? And if that is the case, then what now? Because presumably the whole project was dependent on all parties agreeing on the governance plan that was there.
No, look, first of all, what the board of the HSE were given was an update on all aspects of the overall project. And everyone, including the HSE board, are highly committed to make sure that the maternity hospital move, that it happens. What they were given was an update on all aspects of it. They did look through various aspects of it and did express views on some aspects. They did express views and concerns relating to board construct. They didn't take a position. It wasn't a vote, and they weren't asked to take a position.
Okay. So they haven't rejected it. They've just made some observations about it.
Absolutely. And those observations have been fed back through the chairman to the minister. This is an ongoing process. It wasn't a point of time and taking a position on it. Work continues on in relation to projects led by the Department of Health. That work is ongoing. We will bring further updates back to the board at the appropriate time. And certainly the chairman has been in ongoing discussions with the minister related to any concerns that the board may have. But they haven't taken a position at this point in time. They certainly fed back.
The piece in the Sunday Times today says that the board's audit and risk committee has repeatedly refused in the last 6 months to accept the formula for appointing directors to the board of the new company. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, and that's, you know, that's what has happened. The audit and risk committee of the board did do a very thorough, detailed assessment of it, which what boards should do under the public service code, and brought back a report to the full board. The full board expressed the views that was brought back, supported the views that was brought back by the audit committee. Those views have been fed from the chairman to the, so it's not incorrect that those views have been expressed, but just to clarify, the board didn't take a point in time vote or position on this. It's an iterative process. It was ongoing at that time. It's still ongoing now, and the board will get further updates once there's more to bring back to them.
Okay, so for clarity's sake then, because people might interpret this as being something of a veto, there hasn't been any sort of declarative statement, there hasn't been any vote, and the board hasn't exercised any kind of veto over this as of this point?
No, the board just took an update and fed its views back to the department, to the minister, to the chairman, on some of the concerns, a wide range set of concerns, which is good governance by a board of the HSE, and such an important matter, but highly committed to the project overall.
Does that at least result then in a delay to construction?
No, that's not from the HSE or the board's perspective. It was merely an update on where the project is at. It was merely them feeding back their position. This is an ongoing initiative process led by the department, and the board were merely feeding back their views at the update they were given.
At the very least, though, if this board and the subcommittee are raising some concerns around the governance structure, it does suggest that the structure that the Minister for Health and the government say is completely okay is clearly something which is not universally accepted wholeheartedly by your own directors.
Yeah, and they certainly have fed back in terms of the construct of the board, which was, you know, four members from St Vincent's, four members from National Maternity Hospital, the independent chairman, and just fed back some of their concerns in relation to construct of that. And, you know, that's what, you know, a good board would do, should do. has done on the, in terms of their role under the Public Service Code, has expressed their views to the minister, and you know those views, I'm sure, are being considered. But ultimately, process led by the department, and we will, you know, at the appropriate time, bring a further update back to the board. But it hasn't stalled anything. It hasn't. The board's position on it hasn't set out to stall anything, and it hasn't. It's merely been a point in time feedback that they've given into the process.
One thing worth stressing for listeners who haven't read that whole piece in the Sunday Times today, it does say that the impasse over corporate governance is a separate one to the controversy about religious ethos potentially restricting some of the provision of services on that site. One other issue just on the topic of maternity hospitals, Paul, you no doubt will be aware of some of the disquiet and the upset that's been raised this week by the fact that the Rotunda Hospital, which again we should stress is a voluntary hospital and not directly under your own governance, was allowing crews in to film a TV documentary series at a time when the partners of women entering labour weren't always allowed into the hospital. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I guess a couple of comments. First of all, there is always value, some value, in terms of productions or TV crews producing, I guess, behind the scenes filming that, you know, if you take St. James's Hospital, would have done it during COVID, you know, and it gives the public a really good sense of the health services, the commitment of staff working in those services, trying to protect people during COVID. So there's always value on that. There's no doubt the sensitivity of the timing of this production has caused a lot of upset for everybody. And I can see that. I can hear it throughout the whole week, particularly for some of the restraints or restrictions that have had to be put in place by Rotunda and other maternity hospitals. So it's hit a very wrong.
Yeah, well, especially when they're talking about, I know that there was minimal staff involved because a lot of it was just fixed remotely operated cameras, but some of the staff that were required to gain access to the hospital were allowed to do so on the basis of having passed an antigen test, which wasn't the same liberty afforded to expectant fathers.
Yeah, and look, you know, it's an operational decision made by St. Vincent, or made by Rotunda Hospital themselves, and they'd be best to comment on the rationale or, I guess, the risks that they protected during that process. So, but I do fully accept it was insensitive. The timing of it has proved very insensitive indeed. And it's hit a very wrong nerve for many women and many of their partners.
In hindsight, would it have been better if the season hadn't gone ahead until the restrictions were relaxed somewhat?
Again, and these are all things that an operational decision for themselves, but timing is always important in these things. Okay. And the timing has hurt people, and it's caused a lot of hurt for people, and I think the timing was probably not good.
On that general note, we're looking at a situation where, societally speaking, we'll have next to no restrictions from October the 22nd, only mask wearing in certain circumstances, and yet we'll still have a situation where many of the maternity hospitals will still be implementing guidelines far in excess of what was previously the case as regards visitation for expectant fathers and anyone else. How do you justify there still being such a disconnect between society at large going back to normal and maternity hospitals still imposing restrictions that the vast majority, including even the Minister for Health, would see as unnecessary?
And we've worked hard on this in the past 2 weeks, and the last while. In particular, we've met with advocacy groups, people leading some of the campaigns and initiatives of the advocacy groups in relation to maternity visits for partners. We've had very good dialogue with them. We've tried to work very closely with them to get a kind of pathway that everybody, a shared pathway that everybody can understand and buy into. And that work is ongoing, and we're going to continue that dialogue with those advocacy groups.
But you can't instruct hospitals to follow a certain code, though?
Well, we have. We've set out directions to all of the 19 maternity hospitals are in relation to a whole range of visits, of a total of about 9 different categories of visitations set out. There is compliance with those 9 initiatives that we've seen across the board. There are some restrictions that some maternity hospitals still have to place, and there is still a very live risk. I know it's a difficult one to say and acknowledge, but there is still a very live risk in terms of maternity care and, you know, women in maternity hospitals, the risk that's there to them. And, you know, that's what the medical profession, that's what the nursing and midwife profession, that's what some of these hospitals are trying to get that balance right.
Okay, we're out of time. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Paul Reid, Chief Executive of the Health Service Executive, thank you very much for joining us this lunchtime on The Record.
On The Record with Gavin Riley.
On News Talk.